Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
And welcome to the beginning of the 22nd season of the Poetry Center of Chicago, the season being one in which we, at monthly intervals, present readings of distinguished writers and poets, and sometimes merely promising ones, some of whom have gone on to be distinguished. I'm John Van Doren, and I'm here on behalf of the center. This year's program is described on the calendar, which I think many of you have already received in the mail, and of which extra copies are, I think, available up in the lobby. We hope you'll come to as many of the readings as you can. If you think you can come to all of them, or nearly all of them, you may wish to buy a subscription, which will save you some money. You can look up our telephone number on the calendar and call tomorrow or the next day after that to arrange for this. I will just call your attention now to next month's reading by Stanley Kunitz, which will be on November 8th. This will be the first of our Martha Friedberg Memorial readings, to be repeated yearly, in which we honor one of the founders of the Poetry Center, who served thereafter on its board of directors until she died last January, who gave unstintingly from her funds throughout that time to help defray our expenses, and who at her death did not forget us. Mr. Kunitz would be reason enough to attend this reading, but it will be an opportunity as well for all of us to honor the woman who more than any other person made the Poetry Center possible. Our reader tonight, Tom Gunn, has written so many books of poetry, is by now so well established as a poet of our time, that it seems superfluous to introduce him to you here. Courtesy requires that I do so all the same. And while I cannot hope in the few moments available to me for the task to define his qualities or encompass his achievements, I may observe that even if I had more time and greater powers than I do, I would find it difficult to accomplish either thing. For no poet of our day remains more elusive than Mr. Gunn, notwithstanding 40 years of intense and honest inquiry by himself as to the poetic character, indeed the human posture, which he ought to assume. And such is its variety and extent, no body of work is harder to sum up than what he has given us. Fortunately, we now have his collected poems, published last year, in which we can, each of us, pursue such questions in full possession of the rich and complicated record. If I were to mention in particular any part of this compendium, it would be the section called The Man with Night Sweats, which incorporates a volume, the latest single volume we have had, I think, from Mr. Gunn, which appeared in 1992. This, if not necessarily the best thing he has done, there are too many dimensions to his work for me to arrive at any easy ranking of them, is nevertheless the most sympathetic, the most charged with what we like to call human feeling. As you may already know, many of the poems in it deal with friends of Mr. Gunn who have died of AIDS, whose loss he painfully and lovingly records. I say lovingly, and that is the important thing, for we have had in previous poems by him a good deal of eroticism, but not much of anything that could be called love, being as it is both temporary and impersonal. And we have had much talk of cruelty and death, as we would expect from any poet of our time, but sometimes of a rather literary kind, in one way or another, detached. The Man with Night Sweats is not detached, and it is not impersonal, though its verse continues to be, as always with Mr. Gunn, beautifully controlled. And this is so, I think, because the experience of love and the experience of death have come together for him, as they did once, indeed more than once, for Whitman, with the result that both things are realized in these poems as they could not have been separately, have an intensity for us as we contemplate them, which poetry that recognizes their connection can sometimes generate. Of course, we look to poetry in any case when such feelings in themselves are very strong, are too great to bear, such that we either turn away or find that we are overcome. It is not to divert us that both love and death are always the occasion, as they are so often the subject of songs. But I will not try to say any more about Mr. Gunn than this, among a dozen other things that strike me as equally important, and we'll leave him to speak for himself. Before he begins, let me remind you that after he finishes his reading, there will be an interval, as usual, in which you may put questions to him, and following that, he will sign books for you if you have bought them in the upper lobby. And now, please welcome Tom Gunn.
Thank you very much. I wasn't sure whether I was going to be coming on the right place. Maybe I should have come on at the side. I'm not sure which looks best. all right, I'll give you my feelings. it's very good to be in Chicago again. Very good to be reading here, particularly reading here. I'm going to start with a poem I wrote about 3 years ago. I'll be reading some fairly recent poems written in, let's say, the 90s, and some poems that are included in my collected poems. This is a more recent one. It's called A Home. And it's based on something about 20 years ago, and somebody I don't really remember. I don't remember his face. I don't remember who he was. All I remember about him is I must have asked him something about his childhood, and I remember the chilling way in which he said, "I was raised in a home." Eventually, I came to write a poem about this and was reconstructed it in my own way. A home. "Raised," he said, "not at home, but in a home. Bare of associations, words like bed, breakfast and birthday, hard eternal forms, as standardized as workbench in the shop or regulation metal bunk with edges on which you bark your shins because it's there. Bare of associations. Between the boys, contact not loose, not free, consisting mainly in the wrestling down of slave by slave. Call this the economy of bruises, threats of worse, pin you in place for more convenient handling, and nothing occurs casually but dirt. So, when a big boy slips you a comic book because his heart is big, no other reason, his unfit action organizes time. It organizes time through revelation of an old prophecy preserved in fragments among the boys, a corrupt oral tradition concerning the advent of the affections, for they will be born and live and prosper too, before their inevitable martyrdom. Your mind starts to prepare a place for them, and it delights in the cool, newfound ease with which it slips the habitual, weary tautness to enter certain unmapped borderlands. Waking early in the breathing room of beds to thin, unsupervised light a sanctuary. You glimpse at last a measure of the future in which you will seek out similar times between times, places between places, thresholds and fire escapes, buses and laundromats, to tell in a voice guarded and level, I was raised in a home, as if it were all over, and the quotidian horror had been mastered.
Excuse me. I guess you can't hear me.
Now I'm going to read a set of songs called Troubadour. These were originally, well, there's a story behind this, but it's not really worth telling. These were originally conceived as a basis for an opera. And the subject of the opera was going to be Jeffrey Dahmer. You remember Jeffrey Dahmer? He was the cannibalistic necrophiliac mass murderer who got killed in prison last year. And I call it Troubadour because the troubadour was an idealist. He doesn't look on the loved one as a person, but as a fixed thing. Mainly because the troubadour never got close to her. You know, these were poems written from a distance. I was originally interested in writing about Jeffrey Dahmer because of an account of his first murder, which took place in his teens. He picked up a young man called Steve, who we'd never seen before, who was stripped to the waist, and Jeffrey Dahmer had a big fetish for the male chest, which he thought was the best part of the body. And this guy, Steve, was on his way to visit his girlfriend. Dahmer asked him back for a beer and a joint. So Steve came back for the beer and then said, refused the joint and turned to go. And Jeffrey Dahmer was stricken with this feeling that he was completely in love. He'd known this guy for 20 minutes. And we all know this kind of feeling, don't we? Love at first sight. This is what our culture tells us to expect, love at first sight. However, we don't usually do anything about it. Jeffrey Dahmer came behind him with a barbell and crushed his windpipe. So he did something about it. I wanted this first poem to graze cliché. It's a poem really about cultural conditioning and how it just takes a little extra kink. I think kink is probably the right word there, to make it both part of the conditioning that we recognize, but also different in, very different in consequences. Troubadour, songs for Jeffrey Dahmer, Hitchhiker. Oh, do not leave me now. All that I ever wanted is compressed in your soul body. As you turn to go, I know that I must keep you and know how, for I must hold the ribbed arch of your chest and taste your boyish glow. The strain returns of my desire to own the elusive one I have not even possessed. Though you recoil at my first touch, your flesh yields when it learns that love must be ensnared while on the run, for later it will spoil. I thought that you were gone, but you are here and will remain with me. Your long hair floods the pillow that we share across the mattress we lie quietly on. I trust your mute consent in which I'm free to strip your body bare. My song in each reprise will follow this first order, strain by strain, strain of desire and hope, and worst of all, the strain of fearing loss. But after these, strain of the full possession once again that has a dying fall. The next poem is about his youth also, his teens, before in the year before he went to Germany in the army. I mentioned that he liked weightlifting magazines a lot, and I mentioned two that still exist here. One is called Muscle and Fitness, and the other one is called, is also the title of the poem, Iron Man. That sullen, moody summer when it rained each day, I sat in my room, sat in the kennel of my inaction, with few abilities. My parents were away, getting divorced, I think. I gnawed dissatisfaction. The fridge was broke, but I had booze. I was 17, and half drunk all day, all of the day, I masturbated. My solace was a picture in a magazine, a standard out of Iron Man, muscles inflated. His eyes stared up. I memorized the amorous scowl. I played with myself, absorbed in study of his tan body, burnished like a basted fowl, biceps and pecs. What could I do with such a buddy? And good enough to eat. I was hungry for a life. Life of my own. Life I could own, as cock was my witness. Later, maybe some Fraulein might become my wife. But next day, I would buy the latest Muscle and Fitness. The third of these four songs is called The Visible Man. You know, it's based on that educational toy that children are given, which shows the different parts of the body. And it's about the crawl space in his grandmother's house where he dismembered bodies. It's an address to the already dead, one of his dead victims, the visible man. Now, I can count on you. People are restless and they move too much. But you no longer have a young man's heart, hot for experience without review, pumping responses to the latest touch. We do not need to part. Yet nothing lasts, you know. I tell you what, there is a place divides the house's structure, hidden at the center. If I show you that crawl space, you must show the inmost secrets to me that skin hides. Here, I will help you enter. The head note to one of Ezra Pound's early poems called Na Audiard, which is in Provençal, means Lady Audiard, speaks of a poem by the troubadour poet Bertrand de Born called The Borrowed Lady. And what this consists of is the ideal woman who's assembled in the troubadour's mind out of Lady So-and-so's hair, Lady So-and-so's perfect hair, Lady So-and-so's perfect neck, Lady So-and-so's, yet another lady's perfect nose, and so on and so on. So he makes up the perfect lady out of borrowed bits from other ladies. This is called A Borrowed Man. And it starts in the crawl space still. It has a kind of refrain, Iron Man, Only Love, which changes slightly at times. A borrowed man. Loose in the twilight slot between floor and foundation, I have seen such things committed in your name, Iron Man, Only Love, as would not be allowed above or contemplated without shame. I beg from memory each limb, each body part that's spoiled with time. The sidelong, hungry look of him, from him a stammer, from another a single bicep blue with mother, from one a scalp with hair's regalia, from one large hands and lazy grin, from someone reddened genitalia, and last, the image of the chest from my original conquest, the cage once tented in its skin, now great free-standing ribs that I am leaving as bare bone rather than refleshing best part of the best. Only love, Iron Man. But these are nothing. and I head off to the kitchen, where instead I'll find more tangible effects than what the memory collects. I rove round it to gratify iron love. And if the sight that meets my eye, the cold cuts on the metal shelf, only man, stumbles me till I hesitate, yet I can count on the revival of such heat as will concentrate my scattered force into a self defined by both the circumstances and the accompanying fancies to all of my orgasms past, long dried or wiped off, but now massed steeply through memory's survival. Iron man, only love. They mount and break, and in recapture, flood me with rightness of my rapture. People always think they're right. Sorry, ladies. Some people have complained to me that I should write about Jeffrey Dahmer, but you wouldn't mind if I'd written about Napoleon, who killed far more people, far worse ways, over a far greater length of time, and was a much worse man. You wouldn't mind if I'd written about Julius Caesar. I feel rather, if I may sound arrogant, I feel rather like, they're leaving row after row, rather like Shakespeare after he wrote Macbeth, of whom he didn't approve. Well, we'll get on to other things. Maybe the Poetry Society isn't meant to be like this. Let's make it different. I would, if I can find my list, which is under here, I'd like to read a couple of poems of the streets. This one is called Skateboard. This is about Haight Street in San Francisco, which is very close to where I live. Skateboard. Toehead on his skateboard threads through a crowd of feet and faces delayed to a slow stupidity. Darts, doubles, twists. You notice how nimbly the body itself has learned to assess the relation between the board, pedestrians, and immediate sidewalk. Emblem. Emblem of fashion. Wearing dirty white in dishevelment as delicate as the falling draperies on a dandyish Renaissance saint. Chain round his waist. One hand gloved. Hair dyed to show it is dyed. Pale flames spiking from fuel. Toehead on skateboard, perfecting himself. Emblem extraordinary of the ordinary. In the sexless face, eyes innocent of feeling, therefore suggest the spirit. Here's another much earlier poem. Also, you might say, of the streets. This was another place I lived in San Francisco before that. And I noticed this man. I was going to say old man, but he wasn't that old, but he looked as though he'd been very sick, just sitting in his little porch right on the street. Not one of your grand southern porches, but, you know, a little tiny porch up some steps, called Taylor Street. The small porch of imitation marble is never sunny, but outside the front door he sits on his kitchen chair facing the street. In the bent yellowish face from under the brim of a floppy brown hat, his small eyes watch what he is not living, but he lives what he can. Watches without a smile, with a certain strain, the warmth of his big, crumpled body, anxiously cupped by himself in himself as he leans over himself, not over the cold railing, unmoving, but carefully getting a little strength from the sight of the passers-by. He has it all planned. He will live here morning by morning. It's a poem about a cherry tree. It follows the cherry tree through all of 12 months. Yes. I'm sorry, should I read louder? Can you not hear me well at the back? No. Well, shout out if I get too quiet again. The cherry tree, how's that? In her gnarled sleep, it begins, though she seems as unmoving as a statue of a running man, her branches caught in a writhing, her trunk leaning as if in mid-fall. When the wind moves against her grave body, only the youngest twigs scutter amongst themselves. But there's something going on in those twisted brown limbs. It starts as a need, and it takes over, a need to push outward from the center, to bring what is not from what is, pushing till at the tips of the push something comes about, and then pulling it from outside until, yes, she has them started. Tiny bumps appear at the ends of twigs. Then at once, they're all here. She wears them like a coat of babies. I almost think that she preens herself, jubilant at the thick dazzle of bloom, that the caught writhing has become a sinuous wriggle of joy beneath her fleece. But she is working still to feed her children. There's a lot more yet, bringing up all she can, a lot of goodness from roots. While the petals drop, the fleece is gone as suddenly as it came, and hundreds of babies are left, almost too small to be seen. But they fatten, get pink, and shine among her leaves. Now she can repose a bit. They're so fat. She cares less. Birds get them, men pick them, human children wear them in pairs over their ears. She loses them all. That's why she made them, to lose them into the world. She returns to herself. She rests. She doesn't care. She leans into the wind. Her trunk shines black with rain. She sleeps as black and hard as lava. She knows nothing about babies. I got that not only from a specific cherry tree, but also from my cat, who'd been having some babies. And you know, first of all, the cat won't let the kittens out of her sight. And she takes little trips away. It gets indifferent in the end. And, you know, when they're adolescents, really doesn't want to have anything to do with them. She's brought them into the world. She's got over her responsibilities. I felt the cherry tree was like that. Here's a poem about a mythological character, Arachne. You know who she was. She became a spider. She started as a human being. Am I loud enough now? Or am I variable? What? I'm variable? Well, tell me. Yes, right back there. I'm fine, good. Arachne was a famous weaver and excited the jealousy of the goddess Athena. And the goddess Athena beat her up, and it's bad enough being beat up by anybody, but being beat up by a goddess must be awful. And she hanged herself, and she was then transformed into a spider. This is about the metamorphosis, starting with our seeing her hanging from the ceiling. Arachne. What is that bundle hanging from the ceiling, unresting even now with constant slight drift in the breeze that breathes through rooms at night? Can it be something then that once had feeling? A girl, perhaps, whose skill and pride and hope strangled against each other in the rope? I think it is a tangle of despair, as shapeless as a bit of woven nest, blackened and matted, quivering without rest at the mercy of the movements of the air, where half lodged in, half fallen from the hedge, it hangs tormented at a season's edge. What an exact artificer she had been. Her daintiness and firmness are reduced to lumpy shadow that the dark has noosed. Something is changing, though. Movements begin obscurely as the court of night adjourns. A tiny busyness at the center turns. So she spins, who is monarch of the loom, reduced indeed, but she lets out a fine and delicate, yet tough and tensile line that catches full day in the little room, then sways minutely, suddenly out of sight. And then again, the thread invents the light. Here's a poem called The Stealer. The Stealer is about Eros as thief. He's both the thief who does the stealing, but also he moves along quietly, so he's stealing along in that sense too. The voice of this poem, which I think of as being a kind of song because it, because of the closeness of the rhymes, is not his, but it's the victim's, Eros's victim. The stealer. I lie and live my body's fear. Something's at large and coming near. No deadbolt can keep it back. A worm of fog leaks through a crack. From the darkness, as before, it grows to body in my door. Like a taker, scarved and gloved, it steals this way, like one I loved. Fear stiffens me, and a slow joy at the approach of the sheathed boy. Will he too do what that one did? Unlock me first, open the lid, and reach inside with playful feel. All the better thus to steal. This is a slightly happier poem. It's about a nasturtium. In San Francisco, one of the wonderful things is that the climate is such cool and sunny that nasturtiums grow like weeds. Once you throw down a few seeds in your garden one year, you're never rid of them. Very nice looking weeds too. Not where I come from in England originally, where you get the nasturtiums finally come up and they get black fly at once. And you nurture them, you nurse them. Of course, you have to put out new seeds next year. This is a nasturtium that ventures through a fence, through a knothole into the street, and so it becomes a kind of street flower. If you have street persons, you can have street flowers. Nasturtium. Born in a sour waste lot, you labored up to light, bunching what strength you'd got and running out of sight through a knothole at last, to come forth into sun, as if without a past, done with it, rebegun. Now, street side of the fence, you take a few green turns, nimble in nonchalance, before your first flower burns. From poverty and prison and undernourishment, a prodigal has risen. Self-spending, never spent. Irregular yellow shell and drooping spur behind. Not rare, but beautiful, street handsome. As you wind and leap, hold after hold, a golden runaway, still running, strewing gold from side to side all day. This next poem is called Coffee Shop, and it originally came from was based on a photograph by Ouija, who was a newspaper photographer mainly from the 1940s, maybe the 1930s as well. He used to do a lot of disastrous scenes of accidents and stuff like that. But this is rather nice, a picture by him of two lovers, a boy and a girl, kissing very passionately in a coffee shop. And you can tell how long ago it is because there's a sign above them saying, coffee 5 cents. Well, you don't need to know about this, but you know, you have to fill in something between poems. You have to say something between poems. And I changed the image actually from the coffee shop to a kind of imaginary house of love, which they're discovering and entering halfway through the poem. Coffee shop. I recognize them in the booth, weak, greedy, lovely in their greed, shakily locking mouth to mouth, where mutually they start to feed. The first kiss, prelude to a tale where neither entertains suspicion how they might change, how they might fail. Nothing can shake this recognition. The moment that they break into the closed up house of love, they slip from room to room, and as they do, adventure through a companionship thick with their projects. What is best, they know they'll not be bored again, proud to return the interest they get and think they can sustain. They drag the stocky shutters apart and let light in upon the floor, the dance ground of the active heart, where they could play forevermore, the lovers tangled in mid-phrase, as if obstructed tongues might say, we are the same in different ways. We are different in the same way. Here's a poem which is kind of history of love that was published in the current Paris Review. It's called A Wood Near Athens. The title comes is a stage direction commonly used in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, which of course is a play about love and all the things that can go wrong and right with it. It's a history of love from the Old Testament to the present, which is quite an ambitious thing to do. I make a reference at one point to a Canadian painter called Attila Richard Lukacs, who has a painting of a painting of two skinhead gangs about to fight. You look at it more closely because the configuration seems familiar, and you suddenly realize that it's based on a famous picture by Degas of ballet dancers, where one group of dancers is waiting in the wings and the corps de ballet is already on stage, which is clever and funny. And then at the end, I steal an image of angels from Dante's Paradiso. A wood near Athens. The traveler struggles through a wood. He is lost. The traveler is at home. He never left. He seeks his way on the conflicting trails, scribbled with light. I have been this way before. Think, the land here is wooded still all over. An oak snatched Absalom by his bright hair. The various trails of love had led him there, the people's love, his father's, and self-love. What if it does indeed come down to juices and organs from whose friction we have framed the obsession in which we live, obsession I call the wood preceding us as we precede it? We thought we lived in a garden and looked around to see that trees had risen on all sides. It is ridiculous, ridiculous, and it is our main meaning. At some point, a biological necessity brought such a pressure on the human mind, this concept floated from it, of a creator who made up matter, an imperfect world, solely to have an object for his love. Beautiful and ridiculous. We say, love makes the shoots leap from the blunted branches. Love makes birds call, and maybe we are right. Love then makes craning saplings crowd for light, the weak being jostled after shade and death. Love makes the cuckoo heave its foster siblings out of the nest to spatter on the ground. For love has gouged a temporary hollow out of its baby back to help it kill. But who did get it right? Ruth and Naomi? Tear away Romeo and Juliet? Alyosha, Catherine Earnshaw, Jeffrey Dahmer. They struggled through the thickets as they could. A wedding entertainment about love was set one summer in a wood near Athens. In paintings by Attila Richard Lukács, cadets and skinheads, city boys, young Spartans wait poised like ballet dancers in the wings to join the balance of the corps in dances passion has planned. They that have power, or seem to, they that have power to hurt, they are the constructs of their own longing born on the edge of sleep, imperfectly understood. Once a young man told me my panther made him think of one his mother's boyfriend had on his forearm, the first man he had sex with at 13. Did she know about that? I asked. He paused. I think so. Anyway, they were splitting up. Were you confused? No, it was great, he said. The best thing that had ever happened to me. And once, one looked above the wood and saw 1,000 angels making festival, each one distinct in brightness and in function, which was to choreograph the universe, meanwhile performing it. Their work was dance. Together, wings outstretched. They sang and played, the intellect as powerhouse of love. I'll end up with three short poems about David in the Bible, King David. They're supposed to balance the set of Dharma poems. They have to do with the sense of taste in a kind of punning way. And also, well, you know, I don't want to put it crudely, but somebody else did. I said, why do I feel that these go so well with the other set of poems? And this friend of mine, who's a poet called Robert Pinsky, said, well, so they both will kill for a fuck. Well, I see what he means. Yes, maybe that was what was in my mind. The first of these poems is about David's dance before the ark. He did a kind of free-form dance before the ark, which was the ark of God with the tabernacle in it, which was returning from captivity. He was wearing apparently an ephod, if that's the right way to pronounce it, which is a kind of gauzy robe. And the Bible says what's her name? Michal, the daughter of the previous king, was very shocked at this because he was uncovered. I didn't really understand what this meant until somebody explained to me that this was transparent. So you could see what this lady explained to me was his manhood under it. No wonder she was shocked. So the first of these poems called Dancing David. One, God. I danced before the Lord, before the ark. I whirled and leapt. I danced with all my might, uncovered in the sight of slaves and slave girls, greeting the restored. My dance was play, and yet my play was work that raised a homage to the appointing Lord. I tasted sweat, even though I wiped it off. Beyond, I tasted all-approving air and cut swathes through it, where, learning from it an indiscriminate taste, I drew all things to me, however rough, the harvester in whom God's power is placed. Saul's daughter watched me through the window slit, despised me, took me for vulgarian, a vain and tasteless man. She said, "How glorious was the king today?" Ironic Michal of the unkind wit, taste, taste, good taste will starve your years away. For finicky taste will pucker up your womb that shrinks in your disdain before the dance of my uncouth advance, until it lose ability to swell, no longer a capacious flexile room, but closed and empty like a light nutshell. The Bible doesn't make it clear whether the curse on her fertility is David's or God's, presumably both. The next of the three songs is Bathsheba. Well, you probably know about that. He caught sight of this wonderful-looking woman bathing herself, but she was married. Much later, in Jerusalem, while I was walking on my roof above my people, watching them, king, poet, close and yet aloof, I glimpsed a certain woman nude. I saw Bathsheba from above, washing her breasts in solitude. I learned the imperatives of love. As for her husband, loyal fighter, I had a kingly stratagem. He was to carry me a letter, all unaware it dealt with him. I had him posted for my ends in hottest battle of the lion, and then abandoned by his friends, so I could make Bathsheba mine. Nothing to do this time with taste, but with the fervor of the dance, in which I kicked aside in haste any obstructing circumstance. A common sequence, I observed, love leading to duplicity. Displeasing to the Lord I served, also eventually to me. Yet from such commonness and greed, a wiser king than I was grown, for in our very draining need, the seed of Solomon was sown. The third of these is called Abishag, and this takes place in his extreme old age. He was getting cold, he was dying, and they couldn't get any heat in him. So, this was another time than ours. they found a virgin, a warm young virgin, because he'd always, as you can tell, been one, a ladies' man, you might say. And they laid her body on top of his, but he knew her not. It was, well, this poem is about it. And I have him going back in thought to the original dance before the ark. Abishag. All my defiance in the past, I lay covered with bedclothes, but I got no heat. They sought to take the chill off my old age and found me the lithe virgin, Abishag. She lay on my bosom, oh pubescent girl, smelling how lightly of anxiety. The source of merely temporary mild heat, so innocent she might have been a dog. Therefore, Bathsheba, handsomest of the wives, entering my room, came to the point at once, briskly demanding forthwith my assurance of the succession for her Solomon, and took less notice of the girl than if I had a closed pan of warm embers on me. I relished secretly what I discovered. Citron for a parched thought. Abishag, sweet to the point of sharpness. Dense and damp. A comfort to the memory where I found, already present in the God dance, her, the ultimate moment of the improvisation, a brief bow following on the final leap. Thank you. Thank you.